Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we have the non-fiction writer and novelist Max Adams exploring the role that long-distance walking plays in his work and his life, followed by the novelist and playwright Anne Coburn on the importance of creating a sense of place when writing for children and young adults. First up, here's Max.
In my 20s and 30s, I travelled to America and Africa because there was a whole world to explore and one might as well start somewhere. I wrote about these adventures, poetry sometimes or short stories, and often some of those experiences would find their way into a novel or an idea for a book. I've always walked, but I discovered walking in my early 40s, before I'd ever had anything serious published. Two musician friends and I followed the West Highland Way from Glasgow to Fort William. None of us had done anything so arduous before, and it seemed like a great adventure. It was a revelation that, spending day after day on the trail, waking with a new view every morning. I remember at the end of it thinking that there could be no more natural way to live than walking, existing only in the present, self-contained and taking life at its simplest, the nomad's way. I think now, as a writer, that if I did not periodically set off into the unknown, on foot, with a rucksack on my back and a few days' provisions, I would not be able to write or create anything meaningful. Writing and journeying seem to be two aspects of a single entity. Walking is brain food. It nourishes, enriches the palate, stimulates the body and senses. More than that, it purifies, or at least cleanses. Petty worries are cast off with the miles. A ramble in spring sunshine or along neon-lit city pavements at night has its own rewards, to be sure. But it's sleeping and waking on the trail, day after day, that enlarges that experience into an existence in its own right. Yesterday's horizon receding into the blue yonder, and the future seeping into one's consciousness like an incoming tide. In 2007, I set off with a friend to walk Corsica's infamous GR20. Paul and I had met years before on the West Highland Way and walked many miles together, but the GR20 is something else. 75,000 feet of ascents and descents in 12 days on a mountainous trekking route along the spine of the island. The French Foreign Legion use it as a training exercise. People die on this walk, others turn back. And the week before we arrived, at the beginning of June, three walkers had perished in freak blizzards. But what still seems very odd is that while 12 years on I remember every mile of the West Highland Way, each fold of the hill, each lunch stop and campsite, neither Paul nor I can quite reconstruct our more recent Corsican experience. It was so absolutely overwhelming and intense that its memories are fragmented, like those of the victims of trauma. Well, we made it to the end and drank many a beer in celebration. It was more than a walk. It was a short, self-fulfilling life. Its images and sensations, those that I can remember, are a resource that I can draw on as a writer far into the future. Since then, when I set off, I take with me a sound recorder. I've just been listening again to recordings I made in 2012 on a walk which followed no trail but had only a starting point, my home in the northwest corner of County Durham, and a destination, my friend Paul's house in Paisley. It's about 180 miles. What strikes me, listening to those recordings, is how the sound, me talking, my feet crunching along paths, rushing burns, tweeting birds and passing traffic, takes me back so instantly and viscerally to those 11 days on the trail. And in a way that no written diary, no photograph possibly could. I had no specific writing project in mind, and so far, although I've written about that journey, I've not published any part of it. It has inspired no lines of verse. The experience lies there in my emotional, experiential vault, fermenting and maturing until it is drawn and decanted at some future date, or perhaps never at all. It doesn't matter. The weather, for the first 5 days, was terrible. Unremitting grey skies, temperatures more appropriate to February than May. I walked head down in a sort of stoical one foot in front of the other, trudging resignation along muddy tracks and through Northumberland's switchback lanes, where passing drivers stared mutely disapproving through their windscreen wipers. The pack was heavy, so were thoughts of mortality, loss of faculty, loss of friends, and what might have beens. But the trail always leads on towards its ever-receding horizon. Tomorrow and yesterday are lost in the now. Spring's chattering growth is not silent or still for long. Rain intensifies the 100 shaded greens of hawthorn, beech, rowan and meadow grass, the shy sky blue of the forget-me-not, and the stuff-hue yellow of dandelion. Oatcakes, cheese, nuts and dried fruit are ambrosiac. And every now and then, even in this weather, someone, a knowing member of the same clandestine club, stops to talk of how good it is to be alive in spring. I find periodic shelter in the glistening bluebell wood or fox-reeking rocky overhang, munch on my wayfarer's victuals, and reflect that simple things have their own virtues. One field gives way to another. A gnarled octogenarian Scots pine, leaning stoically into the wind on a hill a mile away, comes closer and closer until I pause on the trail to sit in the fold of its roots and then pass on to the next horizon. I cross Hadrian's Wall, or what's left of it, through a gap a mile wide, a meaningless line in the sand washed clean by time and the tides of man. I see almost no one for days on end, until, high up on the border moors in the shadow of the great wilderness of Kielder Forest, I come across a shepherd out on his quad bike with his collie, and we chat for a while. The campsites are deserted. Some walks are social, for camaraderie and the crack. This walk is for me, and I don't need company. I camp wild under trees dripping with rain and moss, and watch the land passing by at its own pace. Neither of us is in a hurry. I do not carry a watch. I cannot be late, and the sun, if there had been any, tells me what time to get up. I am a transient, never belonging. But as I pass each field, cross each bridge, stroll through each farmyard, village or town, I sense that we have left a mark on each other, writing a history which the motorist cannot claim and is careless of. As the clouds finally clear and a piercingly bright sun begins to beat down, I notice, imperceptibly at first, that I've shed a year or two since I set out to see my friends. The birds and I, we start to sing. Between Jedburgh and Selkirk on the rushing Tweed, I'm seduced by reclining nude folds of hill and glen, buttercup meadow, copse and babbling brook, and by the tragic ululating wail of the curlew. Fair weather clouds now caress the land, and I sit for an age on a nameless summit, watching everything and nothing as the hours pass me by. Only the westward tracking of each day's sun draws me on into the next distance. The pack no longer weighs me down. It binds me tight to the earth, and when I take it off, I feel as if I might float away on the breeze. With these, my immediate needs on my back, I exist complete. Without them, the lightness is unbearable. All journeys have their own narrative, and all writing is a journey. You can never be sure when you write the words, Chapter 1, in 14-point bold underlined, with such optimism that the trail ahead might not get the better of you. And it's no great disgrace to pull out if the game proves not to be worth the candle. But writing and walking can become addictive, and when I take that rucksack off, or push the keyboard away, and return to the life that everyone else seems to have been living while I've been away, the words, the end, are merely a prelude to another chapter one. Each journey's end is no more than the next beginning.
That was Max Adams, recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. You can find out more about Max on his website at www.theambulist.co.uk. That's The Ambulist, all one word. Next, we have Anne Coburn with The Importance of Place in Children's Literature.
There is always a strong sense of place in my writing for children. I invent the characters and the story, but I use a real setting, one I know well. The landscape of Northumberland and the borders runs through all my books. I even managed to use it in my Dream Team series, which is set mainly in another world, Dreamside, the place where our dreams are made. Midge, Snaffle, Vert and Harley are trainee dreamfetchers, and the Earthside town where they go to learn how to deliver dreams is my hometown of Berwick-upon-Tweed. In this extract, Snaffle must deliver a dream to a boy in a hill farm. This farm is a real place, one I cycle past often. The farmhouse was hidden in a high valley that was little more than a crease in the skin of the land. By the time Snaffle found it, his teeth were chattering so much he could not whistle any more. Up in the high hills, the wind was freezing. Frost glittered on the humped backs of dry stone walls. Hillside streams rattled over the rocks with a sharp, cold sound, like ice cubes in a glass. So Northumberland provides me with a ready-made geography, but it also brings an emotional depth, an emotional truth, if you like, to my writing. It's coloured by my own feelings about and memories of the place where I live. For example, I use Berwick as the setting in Glint, a novel about 15-year-old Ellie and her brother Danny. Danny has gone missing on his 11th birthday, and there's a scene in the book where Ellie must search the old swimming pool building, which had been derelict and boarded up for years. It's dark inside, and she's very frightened. She wants to give up. She wants to run. What will make her stay? In that scene, I have given Ellie one of my own memories of the old swimming pool, when it was still working, a memory of going to collect my son from his swimming lesson one day, and of him running to meet me, so excited because he'd managed to swim his first width. I'll read you a passage from that scene. The glass in the door was dirty, and it was difficult to see anything clearly through the grime. Ellie groaned softly. The prospect of opening a third door without knowing what was waiting behind it was too much for her dwindling stores of courage. She turned away from the door and was heading back to the stairs when she was hit by a sense memory so strong it stopped her breath. She caught the smell of chlorine and heard Danny's high laughter echoing around the high-roofed entrance hall. Then she saw him, 6 years old, and racing across the landing with his wet hair sticking up all over the place and his towel trailing behind him. "Don't run, you might slip," whispered Ellie. But Danny had already faded into the darkness again. Ellie swallowed back tears, then lifted her chin and clicked off the torch. Gripping the handle of the door, she eased it open and stepped inside. I'm not alone in using a real place in my books. Many other children's writers display a strong sense of place. For instance, Philippa Pierce in Tom's Midnight Garden is using the garden where she grew up, and L.M. Montgomery in Anne of Green Gables. It's usually a place they know well, and they often use that place over and over again. Philip Pullman and Oxford, David Almond, Felling and the Tyne, Robert Westall, Tynemouth, and Alan Garner, Alderley Edge. I think this geographical rootedness, this sense of place, strikes a chord with children. Yes, even today's children. They may be citizens of cyberspace, seasoned travellers of the World Wide Web, but they also belong very much to the place where they live. I once spent a term working with Year 7 children in Berwick. I asked them to write creatively about their hometown, and my young writers responded beautifully. They described their surroundings with great affection and a deeply rooted sense of place. One boy wrote about the cinder toffee lumps of my Cheviot Hills. Not the Cheviot Hills, my Cheviot Hills. He regarded those dark hills, always visible on the western horizon, as his own. They belonged to him, and he belonged in Northumberland. It was as simple as that. Sadly, a strong sense of belonging is not always beneficial. What if a child's home is not a benign place? In 2008, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation carried out a national investigation into the sometimes harmful effects of territorial geography. They asked young people in cities across the UK to draw maps of their neighbourhood, marking where they felt safe and where they felt at risk. I remember one particularly striking example of two 11-year-old Glaswegian boys who were friends at school. They sat together. But because they lived on opposite sides of their block, the areas they marked safe and don't go on their maps were mirror opposites. They were too frightened to visit each other's homes. Children's authors often make strong use of this sometimes negative territorial sense of place in their writing. Irish writer Siobhan Dowd explores the theme of individual sacrifice in times of conflict in her brilliant Bog Child, by using the same Irish border setting for two historical stories, one in the 1980s and one in AD 80. In contrast, Suzanne Collins takes her American setting far into a dystopian future in the Hunger Games trilogy. When I was writing Glint, I began to play with the idea of a child's sense of place. At the start of the book, Ellie and Danny had just moved to the town. Where would their sense of place come from? I decided they would have to create it for themselves. While their parents sorted out the house and settled into their new jobs, Ellie and Danny spent long, hot days exploring the town, the wild coastline and the sheltering hills. At first they felt lost and unreal in their strange new surroundings. They had no history there, and the place felt as hollow to them as a film set, a frontage with nothing behind it. So they created a history of their own. They acted out the story of a girl called Argent, who loved to visit the dragon cave on the hillside above her village. The story grew stronger with each passing day, until finally Argent and her village felt as real to them as the modern town where they lived. And an alternative landscape lay just under the surface of the hills, like a tattoo under the skin. This brings me to the idea of transformational geography. Children view the place where they live as a liminal space, a space they can transform at will. They do this without thinking when they play. I sent my young Berwick writers off with disposable cameras to take photographs of places that had always intrigued them, and I asked them to create their own legends about those places. They came up with some stunning transformational writing. Concrete tank blocks became giant stepping stones, a monster's rotting teeth. An abandoned building site turned into a hill fort where we stand proud on top of the mud banks and the dens. We stand like warriors before and after a huge battle, proud and sturdy. Sun glaring in your eyes, it is like God is watching you in every detail. Sigmund Freud wrote, "Might we not say that every child at play behaves like a creative writer, in that he creates a world of his own, or rather, rearranges the things of his world in a new way that pleases him." Children's writers use transformational geography too, sometimes through their child characters. In Bridge to Terabithia, Catherine Patterson's characters transform their local woods into a fantasy world, creating a liminal space accessed only by those with enough belief. David Allman's characters often do the same, sometimes through a darker lens, for example in Kit's Wilderness. And what about this wonderful description of a transformed but still very recognisable London in the opening pages of Philip Reeve's Mortal Engines Quartet? The Hunting Ground. It was a dark, blustery afternoon in spring, and the city of London was chasing a small mining town across the dried-out bed of the old North Sea. In happier times, London would never have bothered with such feeble prey. The great traction city had once spent its days hunting far bigger towns than this, ranging north as far as the edges of the ice waste and south to the shores of the Mediterranean. But lately, prey of any kind had started to grow scarce, and some of the larger cities had begun to look hungrily at London. For 10 years now, it had been hiding from them, skulking in a damp, mountainous western district, which the Guild of Historians said had once been the island of Britain. For 10 years, London had eaten nothing but tiny farming towns and static settlements in those wet hills. Now at last the Lord Mayor had decided that the time was right to take his city back over the land bridge into the great hunting ground. It was barely halfway across when the lookouts on the high watchtowers spied the mining town gnawing at the salt flats 20 miles ahead. To the people of London it seemed like a sign from the gods, and even the Lord Mayor, who didn't believe in gods or signs, thought it was a good beginning to the journey east and issued the order to give chase. The mining town saw the danger and turned tail, but already the huge caterpillar tracks under London were starting to roll faster and faster. Soon the city was lumbering in hot pursuit, a moving mountain of metal which rose in 7 tiers like the layers of a wedding cake, the lower levels wreathed in engine smoke, the villas of the rich gleaming white on the higher decks, and above it all, the cross on top of St. Paul's Cathedral glinting gold, 2,000 feet above the ruined earth. Sometimes a children's writer will use a place they know well, but transform it into a setting on another world, replacing details such as flora and fauna with alien but at the same time recognisable creatures. The same but different. Patrick Ness does this in his excellent Chaos Walking trilogy. A strong sense of place is important in children's literature because children also have a strong sense of place. The place where they live has played a part in building their identity. It is also a springboard for all manner of transformational and imaginative adventuring. Grown-ups have mostly lost the habit of transformational geography. As J.M. Barrie wrote about Neverland, "We too have been there. We can still hear the sound of the surf, though we shall land no more." Children's writers are the exception. They have never lost the habit.
That was Anne Coburn, recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. You can find out more about Anne on her website at www.annecoburn.com. That's Anne spelt A-N-N and Coburn spelt C-O-B-U-R-N. And that concludes episode 8. Coming up in episode 9, the novelist Katie Grant speaks with Kona McPhee about history writing, accidental journalism, and her musical adventures. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.